welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're looking at the malign influence of big fruit. That's right, it seems there are secrets about apples that they don't want you to know, and Chuck Wendig, no less, is here to educate you. Chuck's new novel is Black River Orchard, and yeah, it's all about a particular strain of dangerous apple and the damage done to a small American town. Now, this is a book that I loved, both for its nasty ideas and its comforting embrace of old-school storytelling. Chuck and I talk about his approach to writing such big books, about political even-handedness in horror stories, and the inescapable appeal of righteous violence. He also tells me about the best job I've ever heard of. Why not become an apple hunter today? If you enjoy Talking Scared, there's always more. Sign up to be a Patreon and get bonus episodes of all kinds, from deep dives into classic texts, candid reviews, and even some exclusive interviews. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, sign up, listen, and feel my gratitude. Also, folks, Apple Podcast or Spotify reviews are very, very welcome. But now, come with me to a bucolic orchard somewhere in rural Pennsylvania. The trees are flourishing, but the fruit that falls contains sourer juice than you could possibly know. Let's talk scared. Hello, Chuck, and welcome back to Talking Scared. How are you?
Glad to be here is how I am. This is exciting. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's exciting to have you. And you'd have to say thanks. I need to say thanks to you because listeners won't know this, but I let them down and I let you down when it came to Wanderers and Wayward.
Man, you gotta do what you gotta do. You know what I mean? Protect yourself and be a happy man.
Damn mental health and needing rest and stuff. You know, you were very gracious about my inability to cope with a 2,000-page duology. So thank you.
Well, that's the thing. I didn't make it easy on you, and then I'm leaving you with literal doorstoppers to read these, bison bludgeoners, as I call them.
Yeah, I like that. You haven't exactly taken it easy this time. You've kind of got your revenge because Black River Orchard is yet another huge book. Not quite as huge, but still.
It's big. Yeah, it's about 100,000 words shy of those each of those books, the other books, yeah.
Yeah, you could bruise a bison with it at the very least, I would say, you know.
give him a dizzy spell.
Yeah, and it's kind of testament to how good this book is and what I often use the word romp, and I think the word romp often sounds like damning with faint praise, as if it's kind of light and frothy and meaningless. I don't mean that at all, but this book moves at pace, even though it's a big chunky thing. It doesn't hang about, you know. Well, you know what, it's both a slow burner and it moves. Yeah. A lot happens, but it's not like you're rushing. I'm waffling. The best thing is, I think, is as typical, to ask you to introduce the story. Can you take it away for a shot?
Oh, I don't even know if I can. See, that's the funny thing. We're at the point here where I still don't exactly know how to talk about this book. And because it's such a big book, and because there's so much that's happening in it, it's hard to know what the entry point is. Do I talk about the story? Do I talk about where I come from? But I'll just say that a town experiences entering thrall of the strange magic of these seven heirloom apple trees, and it makes everybody happy and better until it starts to change them in ways less positive. But by then they're already in thrall, and it's about a story about the people who are resisting that influence of these strange apples in this sinister orchard.
That's, I mean, the pithiest way to reduce 600 pages.
Oh, God, it's hard.
Well done. I mean, I often deal in comps, you know, when I'm tweeting about books and stuff, and yeah. I sometimes worry that comps are too reductive, that they make people think it's specifically one thing when it's a lot more. In this case, the one I've been banding around is that it is, and I've explained a bit of this as well, I think it's like if you took John Langan's The Fisherman with its new American mythology.
Yeah.
And if you combined it with Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Ooh.
And that kind of paranoia.
Okay.
And then the one that, I was going to say needful things, because the whole thing about a town getting what they want and tearing itself apart. But actually, the more I read, and I only finished it this morning, it reminds me a great deal, and brace yourself, because this might sound like damning with faint praise. It reminds me a great deal of the Tommyknockers.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Well, do you not see
okay,
that?
Interesting.
Do you, has that not occurred to you already?
No, it hasn't, actually. The one comp I've seen the Needful Things comp. First of all, the Fisherman comp is, that's very kind. There's no damning with faint praise on that one. That's a brilliant book. I kind of feel like, especially in the John Compass angle, I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the Stephen King comp, I saw someone say Salem's Lot. And here all kind of, I mean, it's not a spoiler for the book, but something that most people have not understandably picked up on is I kind of wrote this as a vampire novel. I wanted to write a vampire novel without vampires and see if that could work. That's a comp that I like. But the Tommyknockers, that's interesting. It's been a while since I've read it. Tommyknockers.
Well, I mean, it gets the shit kicked out of it, right? The Tommyknockers. But what I mean by that, and it's weirdly, it is a thing I think it shares with Salem's Lot. It's a very particular thing that I think King does well and you do well in this, which is you balance the weirdness of this kind of mini apocalypse in this small town.
Yeah.
With the fact that life is going on as normal. Because in Salem's Lot, people are disappearing every night, but people are still going to work and to school. In the Tommyknockers, it's this weird infiltration of people's brains and the whole thing about being made better than they are. And the bit that this kind of like new evolution that the characters go through and your characters go through. But that's all happened against a really mundane, everyday background. And I always think that must be a really difficult thing to balance when you're telling a story of this scale.
Yeah, I literally viewed it as like the growing of trees. Like a lot of the growth of trees and plants is happening underground. The roots pushing through things is something we don't see, especially when it's something invasive, right? Like a wisteria or any sort of vinous sort of invasive. So much of it happens underground that by the time it's bursting out of the surface, we don't even realize how, you know, widespread the thing is growing. And so that's really what I was trying to kind of angle with. Like this thing has been slithering underground for a good half of the book before the people in and around this area even really start to catch up to what's going on.
Yeah, completely. And if COVID showed us anything, it's that life can be pretty mundane even whilst the most remarkable things are happening on a macro scale.
It absolutely can. And that's also part of the sort of the thinking and the vibe because of this book is like when things are terrible, we kind of resort to life. Just we return to routine and the mundanities of our basic existence.
Yeah, we've started somewhat philosophically there, so let's get a bit more sort of materialist. Ages ago now, I think before I really knew about your work, I saw you blogging about apples, about your haunted apple book. Now you're pretty entertaining online, right? So I assumed at first it was a kind of joke.
If only.
No, here we are, a very serious epic novel about apples, and I finally get to use this pun properly. What was the seed of this story for you?
Oh, you did it, you hooked it. Man, there's a lot of seeds for this story. The biggest one is that when I went to a farmer's market several years back, pre-pandemic, an orchard popped up at this, not just literally, but they, you know, as the fruit season started in the middle of the summer season, here was an orchard with their stand. And they were called North Star Orchard. And they had what they called their, you know, heirloom apples. And there was not a single apple I recognized. And it, like up until this point, I really had not been particularly interested in apples or fascinated by them. They were a fine fruit. You go to the grocery store and you'd be like, you would eat one. You'd be like, well, that was fine. Let's put it in a pie and that'll be the best version of this particular thing. Like I remember being out in Colorado at one point many years ago, over 10 years ago, and having an apple out there that was literally one of the best pieces of fruit I had ever eaten. But for the most part, it was not a thing I was chasing or interested in. So here I am at this, you know, farmer's market stand seeing fruits like Ashmead's Kernel and Lord Lamborn. And I'm like, so these are what, like vampires and hobbits, right? I mean, that's what I'm reading here. These are fake. This is, you're just making this all up. This is just what, Honeycrisp and Pink Lady. And they're like, no, these are real apples. And I was like, okay, that sounds insane. So I'm going to buy like them all. I've never heard of these things. So I'm going to buy them all. And I took this whole bag of strange apples home and I started to eat them. And I was like, none of them taste the same. And none of them taste really like I anticipate any apple should taste. Just from there, I became kind of fascinated with the fact that there's this entire agricultural section of our world that has been forgotten. So that kind of speaks to power structures and capitalism and how things travel and what we, you know, seek as consumers and what the stores can offer us. I thought, well, that's fascinating. And then I kind of got into reading about orchards and small town orchards, and that was fascinating to me too. So like right there is kind of just the seed of like, well, here's this part of America, part of our history. Because, the idea is American is apple pie, whatever. Like, we've just forgotten this. There's so many heritage antique varieties just from our country alone that we've almost entirely lost. So that was interesting to me. And then I found, and I talked a little bit about this in the afterword of the book, I found a note in my couch.
Mm.
And I have it sitting, I have it pinned to my corkboard. I cannot explain this note. It has three demon names on it. It has Adramelech, Mephistopheles, and Baphomet. And it has the ME, in each of those demon names underlined. It is not in my handwriting. Oh, and there's an exclamation point at the bottom. I did not write this. This is not my handwriting. I do not know who wrote this. No one is ever in my shed besides me. I do not frequently have weird demon worshiping guests, as much as that would be fascinating to do so. So I don't know where that came from, too. And so there was this sort of another seed planted in the soft earth of my brain that was about demons and selfishness, this like sort of the me underlined in each of those, and this sort of that collective American narcissism that I think, and I don't mean that in the literal mental illness sense, I just mean it as sort of a cultural myopic sense. Those things kind of clashed together in an interesting way in my brain. And I kept kind of rooting to this idea of like, how do I tell a story about weird apples and that American selfishness? Like, what can I do with that? And eventually over time, this book appeared.
I've got so much to ask you, right? So I'm trying to, as ever, I'm kind of mentally taking inventory of the questions I want to ask you. So let's stay with the apples first and foremost. I mean,
yeah.
One of my favorite things, right, is to learn things from fiction. I have learned so many more facts from fiction than I've ever learned from textbooks or nonfiction.
Yeah.
Like little things that people put in their stories to flesh them out, stick in my brain in a way that facts and figures and tables don't, you know. So I am now a complete convert to the joy of apples and the absolute sadness of the fact that there are so many apples we're never going to taste.
Yeah, that's my job is done then. Good.
Yeah. I mean, I knew we had Big Pharma and Big Tech, but we could really do without Big Fruit, you know.
Yeah, Big Fruit. And the UK has a number of great sort of older varieties that are I know being lost even there, but certainly lost here. Like there's a lot of your varieties that we simply will never get. Some we started to grow, but
this is really not a topic for a horror lit podcast, but I get very, very angry at the quality of vegetables and fruit in supermarkets in the UK.
Yeah,
really dreadful.
And they don't have to be. You can grow vegetables and fruit there. It's totally a thing you can do.
The romantic side of this, are there really apple hunters like your character John Compass? Is that a real thing?
Oh yeah, Tom Brown and I'm trying to think of the other guy. I mean, they're not the only people, but yeah, absolutely. There are people who commit themselves to finding lost varieties of apples. And they some of them simply grow them and then sell the apples. Some of them actually grow the trees and then sell either the trees or the scions of the trees. Yeah, absolutely. And they do it kind of similar to how it's done in the book. They try to find a lot of primary sources that are local and letters and journals or a hint if someone just tells them, oh, my grandmother, she used to have these great apples that I've never tasted before. And you'd be like, well, I'm off to the races. I got to see what that is. And you go to that property and see what they can find. And some apple trees are really old. I mean, 100, 200 years old. So, yeah, that's exactly a thing people do. Not a lot.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's kind of the charm of it,
yeah.
right?
Is right
it's
yeah.
almost like the, I almost think of it as like, you know, the old man in the village you can douse for water. And it's like
right,
a
wash. Right. Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. I mean, once you come across something like that, that must be like, that's got to go in a book at some point, filed away for a future book.
It does. Yeah. How could I write a book about apples and not include a character like that? So John Compass was born of that.
Well, I have questions about John Compass that tie into broader my broader thoughts on heroes and characters, but I'll ask that towards the end. Because I'm going to ask a thorny question now, which I'm perhaps you're not the right person to pose this question to as the author. Perhaps it's more a question for the reader. But you've mentioned American Narcissism and the kind of that side of things.
Yeah.
What in this book, what is the apple a metaphor or a symbol for? If anything, or is it just an apple?
Well, it's both. I don't think I have a specific symbol or metaphor in play, other than I think we as Americans, and this is I don't think unique to Americans, but certainly it's something I view here, that we are, and it also speaks to sort of the nature of why we have the loss of so many apples in the first place. We want things to be easy. And I think we want things to be that sort of get rich quick scheme idea. Like, I want the easy thing that makes me better. I want my skin clear. And if I just eat this food, I will have a clear body and nutritionally I'll be perfect. And we just kind of want these easy sort of answers and easy solutions. But again, then I also sort of think of that almost vampiric promise of like, well, all I have to do is what, I get bitten and then I become immortal and perfect, right? So that, let's just do that. There's like no consideration of the downside. That sort of the allure and lore of being better than you are, I think is a fascinating one. And then when you get into sort of this, in the book itself, sort of has this small town classicism happening. And the jealousy and envy of who has power over you and how you are able to supersede that or not supersede that, as it were, you know, ultimately the apple is that idea of temptation. And then, you know, mythologically, right, you have, and it's weird because we have that new COVID variant, Eris, but then, you know, mythologically you have Eris and her golden apple, which she writes like to the most beautiful or to the fairest, and she, you know, tosses it into a gathering of gods and be like, chaos ensue because now you're all going to fight over who thinks they're the best. So it's kind of all packed into that as to what it specifically represents. Maybe it's just an apple. I don't know.
The reason I ask, you mentioned classism. Okay. Mm-hmm. And to me, the entire story can be, like all good horror stories, let's face it, can be read as sort of allegorical or political with a small p.
Yeah.
And we spoke at length last time about politics in your writing, so I'm not going to belabor the point, but you know, a couple of questions. The eating of the apple, the consumption of it, and it marks a kind of threshold in the book, yeah? Mm-hmm. A sort of entering into a different, superior, detached, closeted perspective. And basically, I just kept thinking of the cult of Trump.
Yeah, sure. You've taken a bite of something and it tasted really good, whether it's good for you or not. And you're going to keep eating. You're going to keep eating no matter what you lose in that process, losing family in that process, possibly.
And the flip side is also, there's also an elitism there, which, you know, is what other people with other perspectives would say the other side of the aisle represent, you know, and it got me thinking about your work in general, because in the past I've heard or read commentary on your novel that says you largely treat conservative politics or leanings in that direction as kind of synonymous with villainy. And I don't know how you feel about that, but in this book you seem to spread the corruption much more widely and much more kind of across different parts of the town.
Yeah, I it's funny because that criticism is one where usually that tells me something deep about the reader, and that they associate with not just conservatism, but a deeper, what I honestly would consider a deeper villainy, the sort of the true racist, bigoted side of that, the deepest right wing. Because, like, you know, in these books, like even in Wanderers, which I think, you know, we didn't talk about specifically, but the liberal Democrat president is completely ineffective. That is not a character who's getting things done and doing the right thing. In Book of Accidents, I mean, you have a family who the father sort of clearly seems to identify as Democrat, progressive, whatever, but he has been a cop. He's sort of aware of the failings and the dangers of that, but sort of retains still that identification, and is also just a completely blocked up mess of a person, like, and it is sometimes the cause of some of the problems in the book. So, I mean, I'm not trying to like let, you know, make it so there's like this liberal paradise of protagonists and the conservative villains. In general, I'm always trying to be aware of like the failings of people in general, regardless of their political perspective, and not to be like a both sides is bad. I just mean like, you know, people are messes as a rule, and that your political persuasion does not prevent you from being a mess. But the only time I'm really demonizing anybody is when they're that sort of deepest right wing, they're violent militia, they're white supremacists, they're Nazi characters. So when people are like, he really hates conservatives, I'm like, do you really mean that I don't like Nazis? Because that's true. I don't. And they make a pretty good, easy villain. And if you're mad at that, but it's the same people who are like, why does Indiana Jones have to always punch the Nazis? You're like, okay, I get it. I see what you're going with. And I know who you are now.
Yeah.
So please get away from me.
Yeah, it's the whole Nazis have feelings to take.
Yes, whole Nazis. Know, just... Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, with Orchard, yeah, no, I'm not, you know, Dan Paxson, you know, is, I don't feel like this is a person who would identify necessarily, I mean, maybe as a Republican. I don't really worry too much about their political perspectives or what party they're voting for. But yeah, I'm not trying to make it just so like, you know, the good guys are blue and the bad guys are red.
Well, if anything, Dan Paxson reminds me of Jim Jones, who began as a very liberal kind of force.
Oh, yeah.
In the world. And
absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, it goes to Flavor Aid. Everybody's drinking poison.
Well, for that reason, actually, perhaps power is a better word than politics. You know,
this is definitely a book about power.
Yes, and influence of many kinds. And because everything from the very real, very cynical influence of this establishment called the Cross Keys Club, you know, like the local... I don't know what in America you have lots of these clubs like Rotary clubs and things like that.
Yeah.
I never quite know what they are, but it's that kind of high society club. And then you've got Calla, who is this young teenage girl. You've got her very overt attempt to be an influencer through social media, and it did feel like you were really riffing on the variety and impacts of influence.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Who are these people? How do they connect to the larger systems of power? How do they try to become powerful themselves, and what do you have to sacrifice to do that? And then is there a point when you pump the brakes? You know, is there a point when you kind of are all in, or it's too late? You didn't realize how all in you were until you're already lost to it. You know, there's a sort of a seductiveness to that. There's a temptation to all of that. And I kind of wanted, you know, to have that all in the book while at the same time not being so heavy-handed that I'm like, you know, you never really want to be lecturing. You never want to be like, I'm going to sit down and tell you how this works. But just make this a thing that's in the book and a thing that you kind of understand both where it comes from and see where it's going in the worst way possible.
You write very well about Calla's online life. And it made me feel very old. It made me feel really old. Because I was speaking about somebody recently, and I can't remember who, where I asked if they turned to their daughter as the person to help them with this. Who was it? My mind's gone blank. But yeah, if I was to try and use like online TikTok slang, I just think I'd either be wrong or just so inauthentic. I mean, how do you do that? Because it does feel like you really do capture that kind of discourse.
Well, first of all, I'm sure I've gotten it all wrong, and there will be a number of TikToks about how wrong I was. Because then I don't actually use TikTok. I don't have it installed on my phone. I mean, obviously, I watch them on, you know, various other sites. It was the balancing act of trying to be just authentic enough without being so deeply authentic that, because TikTok, you know, when I was writing this book, I'm like, it's very possible that TikTok won't exist by the time this book comes out. It's very possible that, ironically, Twitter won't exist, and it kind of doesn't in the way that we understand it. So trying to be cautious about being like, well, I want to inject some authenticity to that without it being so specific that if in 2 years people would be like, wait, what is this? Like, we're all now in, you know, this circle space, facey spaces land, and like it's a whole other app and nobody talks the same. So, you know, I wanted to capture that uniqueness of the moment while still trying to make it as universal as possible to anybody who's ever been online.
Yeah, it's a weird thing that, right? Because when King was writing about, I keep mentioning King, but to me, his work is in such dialogue with yours. Like when he wrote about pop culture and brands, there was a sense that he was working in 30-year arcs. You know, Pepsi Cola didn't go away.
Right.
But now it's like things move so fast that you're writing a book, it takes 2 years to come to print and publication. Yep. Like anything could have happened in that time.
Yeah, culture is not only fast, but diffuse, right? Because like, I mean, you look at the way music was when, you know, King was writing 30 years ago. Like if he referenced a song, it's probably a song we all have heard in some capacity.
Yeah.
Even if it's not a top, you know, 40 hit. It's probably something that I know the band or I know the song, whatever it is. But like now, I mean, and it's true with books. It's true with music. It's true with everything. There's like smaller sort of fiefdoms of fandoms that gather around these things, which maybe makes the audience for that thing sort of stronger and more potent, but it shrinks the audience. And so you don't have as much of a universal. I can't just reference a song. I mean, unless it's like a megastar, like I'm going to say Taylor Swift. If I reference anything, there's a middling chance anyone will understand it. Obviously, something like TikTok or Instagram are more bigger cultural juggernauts at this moment in time and may remain that way for a little while. But it's hard. You just write the story and hope that people get it. Even if they don't get that one specific thing, that the story overall still resonates in a bigger cultural way.
Well, I think in this story, it particularly works because you can almost juxtapose the very diffuse and transitory nature of some of these things with the apple, which is this kind of eternal symbol, right?
Right.
You know, the apple has been around forever. And it's there in it's in pretty much all mythology and folklore I can think of. I think it's quite hard to find a culture that doesn't have an apple somewhere in it.
Sure.
And I did wonder, not to ask you why, I've started doing this, I've got this habit now asking authors why they didn't write something else. It's really irritating.
That's fair. I'm ready.
I kept expecting it to be the apple from the Garden of Eden or something like that. I kept expecting it to be this mythological fabled apple. And it isn't. It's a very American thing. You know, was that a direct choice you made?
Well, yeah, because I don't, almost like talking about TikTok and Instagram, there's a danger in being too specific. You know, and I think if I am to embrace, you know, the apple and its influences in this book as being as sort of universal and sinister as they are, I think it kind of like tarnishes it to be like, and actually it's from the Garden of Eden. And like, I don't, first of all, because now I'm committing to like a biblical reality, right? Just on a basic level. And then whatever that says about that dichotomy between Adam and Eve and the temptation of the snake, like it becomes maybe a little heavy handed and it gets that back to more of that lecturing preaching thing. Whereas if it's kind of a little more spread out, a little more hazy, it's kind of through a smearier lens. It could be a lot of different things. And then it also speaks to the universality of this thing in mythology, that it's not just one thing. It's that this exists in our understanding of sort of the universal grasp we have of both temptation and the temptation of this particular special fruit, this candy, this food, this drug, this lifestyle, this way of being, this influence, this power. And I wanted that to be something that everybody can understand without it being rooted to a very specific cultural, mythological, religious thing.
Yeah, it's like I was listening to my friend Nat Cassidy talk on the Books in the Freezer podcast of the day about vampire fiction and how as a Jewish man it's quite odd for him to see the cross being used as such a weapon, you know, because as if the cross is this universal symbol of what it is. That had never occurred to me. Obviously I'm so entrenched in my own culture, it had never occurred to me that these symbols are not meaningless but mean something much less or much different to other readers. You know, it's a kind of new epiphany I've had.
Yeah, it confirms like a Christian reality of vampire culture, and it's fascinating. Yeah, it's totally right, and nestlings is so fucking good.
I haven't read it yet. It's coming up on the show in October. Mm. It's got, I think it's got the coveted Halloween spot, but I haven't read it yet. It's looking forward to
and Mary,
it.
And sure Mary.
Oh, Mary's amazing, right? Talk about so good. Books that in dialogue with King. Mary's incredible. Yeah. If you haven't read Mary, listeners, go read Mary. It's great.
Do it.
But stick on this Apple theme, because how can I not? How often do I get the chance to talk about apples? One of the most one of the most interesting conclusions, I suppose, that this, that Black River Orchard offers is that your apple does not actually create evil. It just makes you, in one character's words, more of what you already are.
Yes.
That strikes me as a much more interesting angle to write about than something that just makes you bad.
Yeah, because I don't... Again, like, so much of this book was always about trying to walk that line between, like... You know, because horror, right, has the chance to be really just sort of overt and obvious. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, sometimes it's like, look, there's a vampire and he's sucking your blood, and it's it becomes this very visceral, sort of clearly defined evil. But I, you know, when I say that, like, human beings, whether no matter your political spectrum or your level of power in this world, are kind of messes, that's sort of what I'm like. I want to get to that, like, we could all fall prey to this thing. And it's not necessarily that we are trying to be evil. Because people rarely, like, how often in real life, I mean, in fiction, obviously, sometimes evil is simply evil, like, ha, 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 Snidely Whiplash, turn the mustache. But, you know, in real life, people are, like, just usually selfish kind of messes. And that's usually where vulnerability comes in. It's like, well, but it's easier to do this, or it's faster, or it is more satisfying to me and more pleasurable to me, or I did this thing and it gave me a boost to my life, my social standing, my this, my that. And like, am I willing to give that up now that I have it? And, you know, I wanted this to be, I think for that evil, quote unquote, to be seductive, for it to be tempting, it has to be with those kind of sharper edges sanded down at first. Like, you can't see it as, well, it's obviously the apple is evil and it's just corrupting you and making you into a monster. Like, the monstrousness comes sort of as a result of the desires and you becoming so much better that to give that up would feel like the worst thing in the world, like the gravest sacrifice of them all, even though you've already sacrificed so much to become this thing. If that makes sense. That was really vague. It's a very ambiguous answer, but I'm trying to dance around some of the stuff. Yeah.
It does lead to interesting developments, though, because you managed to wrong foot me. I mean, talk about, you said it, horror can be obvious. Yeah. Not only did I not predict who the villain of this book was going to be, I actually thought he was going to be the hero for a good while.
Good. I was going for that. Good.
And I'll say no more, because I want other readers to experience that same journey. Yeah, it in terms of who people are, when the apple exposes them, that is a kind of journey for the reader as well, because we don't really know who these characters are, with the exception of Meg, who I really hated.
Yeah, but like, I also still tried to be like, I kind of understand where Meg comes from. Like, once you start to meet her mother, and you're like, Meg was kind of made this way a little bit, right? Like, this is like, you know, there's something there. There's obviously something there that Emily sees. Man, yeah. It's fun writing that stuff.
I could feel you really making an effort to be balanced and give me a thread to hang on with, to empathize with Meg. I could feel you doing it. And I was like, no,
but I also want you to hate her.
No, I hate this woman.
Yeah. I also need you to hate her. Like, that's the, this is one of the fun parts of writing. And I don't understand people who just want, like, plot. Like, man, character is where it's all at, right? Yeah, like,
completely.
It's the total fertile ground for this stuff to grow in, metaphorically.
Well, I mean, this is one of those books, and this is the highest of praise from me. It's one of those books where the plot is largely a kind of amorphous thing in which you just let the interesting stuff happen. You know what I mean? I don't think the book's really got a plot. It's got a sort of scenario, and then you let the characters run amok and get up to whatever they want to get up to and stuff. It's not really a plot-driven book in that sense, is it?
No, I don't know how much I didn't listen to my last appearance on the show, but, and I don't know if I talked about this at all, but for me, plot is always best when it is subject to the characters. In other words, I say plot is Soylent Green. It's made of people. Characters say things and they do things in pursuit of their let's say, their goals, but sort of in general, characters have a problem. Goals are sort of a little too amorphous, I think, for a writer. And they can be kind of like, I want to be this or have that. But for me, it's more interesting to have conflict and problem. Character confronts problem and must solve their problem. But the road to the solution of that problem is kind of the book. And then you have all these other characters who want opposing solutions or who are trying to exacerbate that problem. And they're sort of constantly in motion with each other. They're sort of either in parallel structure or in perpendicular structure. And when they do that, it creates all of this agitation and all of this drama and conflict. And that's just sort of plot. Things are happening. Mm. People are doing things in pursuit of their goals, their fears. They're trying to conquer problems. And in doing that, a story occurs. And it's so much more satisfying than trying to envision this external exoskeleton of like, well, then it must rise and fall here. And this is the sort of arc. And because if you do that, I think it becomes that kind of save the cat, like, well, you've got to hit these beats and then it's exciting and then it's not exciting. And then the triumphant moment. And it becomes this sort of a little cliched, obvious hit you on the head with a hammer thing. And I don't want to do that. It's why, you know, we keep talking about King, but I mean, someone like King, I think, really gets that. He is more than happy to spend some time with characters. You look at something like the story of the Dark Tower, both structurally internal to each book and also overall. These are books that kind of in a general sense meander, but they meander in such a beautiful, fascinating way because it's sort of about the pursuits of these characters. They have the things that they are trying to do and the problems they're trying to solve, and the story evolves from that. To me, it's just such a beautiful way to tell a story, and it tends to be organic and natural then for the storyteller, because you just gotta, if you kind of know these characters and you, like you say, you just let them run, all you gotta do is follow along.
Yeah, as opposed to and the egregious example I always think of, a bit obscure, this is the later Pirates of the Caribbean movies, where can tell that they're making those films and they're making decisions purely so that by the final reel the right characters can be on the right boat to have the fight. And everything before it has just been moving pieces on a board to make sure they are where they're supposed to be by the end.
You can always feel that.
Yeah, and it's what's reverse engineered, I suppose, is the word. It just feels so artificial and constructed. Whereas, your characters feel like they are just reacting to a scenario, to a situation, and it does feel very... Yeah, I suppose organic is the word. I can't really do better than that word. It feels organic. At no point did I feel like I knew, oh, they're going to do this, and that's going to happen because of this. And
see, and organic's also an agricultural word, so we just keep bringing it back. Seeds and agriculture, it's good. Fertile ground, we're doing good.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful stuff, yeah. I mean, speaking of these characters, though, I love books about ragtag groups of heroes in small towns.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize until writing sort of notes for this book that that's what I love most about the kind of huge horror novels of the 80s and 90s, that they have the space for these multiple strands, different heroes, different villains, all with competing agendas and different points of view. But I also think that kind of story offers more hope. The idea of a collective fight back as opposed to, you know, the righteous avenging angel.
You're right. Like this comes, I think... from, first of all, obviously being a reader of those books in the 80s and 90s. I've talked about the book, one of my favorite books of all time is Swan Song. So good. Just one of my favorite things in the world.
For listeners, that's by Robert McCammon. I recommend you read it.
absolutely read it. Especially since we keep renewing our nuclear fear. So that's a good one. Good one to check out. But also, I both played role-playing games then and then ended up writing for the role-playing game industry for a number of years. And I do love that idea of, you know, ragtag group of characters put together with competing agendas who still kind of like froth and bubble their way toward something. I don't think it's always a purely optimistic end. And I'm not going to spoil anything about Orchard. I think definitely it offers more hope than the type of story where it's like that single protagonist who is going on a deep descent and that's sort of the end, right? Like a descent to this moment of terror and horror and revelation. And there's nothing wrong with that. I love those stories too. That sort of deep horror nihilism. And I find that's easier to accomplish with a singular, maybe a pair of protagonists than it is with the sort of the group. The group has a different kind of dynamic to it. absolutely.
Yeah, because I suppose optimism is the wrong word, if I use that word. It's more that the act of fighting it together, win or lose, is a positive thing. You know, that's, right. I think, is what I get from it.
Yeah, whereas the single protagonist is lonely, right? I mean, it's someone alone feels hopeless in an upsetting way. More hopeless, anyway.
Yeah, I think there's something. I mean, it goes back to Dracula and what do they call it? The Company of Light, whatever they used to refer to those characters as, but that sense of coming together to fight a great evil, the fabric of that is hopeful, I suppose, win or lose.
Well, I think we look for that in life. It's like that whole Mr. Rogers, look for the helpers kind of a thing. Like you're looking for the helpers, but then, and I think especially in horror novels where this is the case, you're not finding the helpers, you have to become the helpers. And that's maybe not the worst message in the world.
No, it's quite, particularly now with things like climate change and stuff and the idea that no one is coming to save us. Quite clearly, no one is on the way with a superhero cape to save us.
Yeah.
It's that tipping point where you realize, oh, maybe I have to be the one or one of the ones, you know. It is a terrifying thing about adulthood, that the realization that if you want to make things better, you've got to do it.
Yeah, right.
But when you're starting a big multi-arc expansive novel like this, what are you feeling at the start? Is it anticipation? Is it limitless potential? Is it a profound fear? I can't imagine what it must be like to sit down and go, right, okay, page one of this next epic.
Yeah. First of all, I don't write them as epics. Like, I don't try to. I'm not aiming to make them these huge books. I start with the characters, and I'm like, you know, this book is going to be, it's something I learned with Wanderers, right? Because like when I was writing Wanderers, I was up on a deadline and I was 180,000 words into this book and I was not finishing it. Like it was nowhere near an end. And my editor, Trisha Narwani, brilliant editor, Del Rey, said, the book has to be as long as it has to be. It's going to be what it's going to be. So just keep writing. And at that point, I was like, well, clearly she's been taken hostage, right? I mean, this is a kidnapping situation. This is the way my editor is letting me know she's in danger. But I was like, well, you know, I'll just ignore her peril and I will continue to do what she said. And so I did sort of continue to write. And I added another 100,000 words to that book before it was done. And that's what it was printed at. That's like the book as it came out, 280,000 word novel. And so, but I didn't aim to do that. It was not a thing that was in my mind that, like, well, this is going to be about this shape and this size. And so I've taken that to heart, that I'm just going to let the books talk to me and be the story that they're going to be. And so for me, the terrifying beginning, because writing a book is always a little terrifying, right? You've got a blank page and it feels like a beautiful a lawn or field after a snowfall. Like you're like, if I go out there, I'm going to mess it all up. It looks pretty now and I'm just going to muck it up. So mucking up the blank page is a terrifying moment, but you have to do it. So my first footprints are always character. Like, introduce these characters in an interesting spot that tells me something about them. It provides a little bit of conflict, but not so much conflict where it feels like, you know, that we can't go bigger, right? I mean, you have to, any conflict has to build and get worse and gnarlier. And that's when we're off to the races. And then I know something about them. And then I can start kind of building and layering on that.
Right, but when is there a feeling? Because you basically, you now have the, let's be honest, you now have the opportunity to write books that are kind of as big as you want, because you are doing. And I always imagine, like, when I get a book like this, when I open a book and I see prologue one and prologue two and then interludes, I get such a thrill, because it's that 80s, 90s thing we keep talking about. I love it, that maximalism. I just love it. But the feeling I have when I open a book that looks like yours is a sort of sense of excited anticipation that there are no limits on this story. This could go anywhere because it has the space to do so. As the writer at the start, do you have that feeling?
Yes. Yeah. If I, like I said, especially with not aiming for it to be one size or another, I do feel free to be like, well, this is going to, you know, this is the thing, right? It's not like I'm trying to be like, well, it's got to be a 60, 70,000 word thriller paced story. Like, if it is, it is. But that's because that's what the story should be. Not because, like, well, I'm trying to hit a market niche or a narrative sales viewpoint. So for me, yeah, that's freeing. I mean, it's terrifying when it's freeing too, in a way. Like, sometimes it's easier to have a very clear directive. Just do this, like, you know, line it up and do this. So it's also terrifying, but I do like it, yeah.
And what about writing a story that takes place over a long period of time, which is getting, getting rarer and rarer in fiction? You get a lot of books that take place over 3 days, a lot of books that may take place over 30 years, like saga type things. But this book covers, you know, the best part of a year, two-thirds of a year, something like that. I mean, does that take its own kind of skill or approach?
Oh, it does, yeah, because it's so much easier. And I think it's why you see movies really do things too fast, right? Like, if you watch, like, one of the things I'm struck by the specifically the new Star Wars films is, like, they feel like they all happen over, like, a course of a 24-hour period. It's not possible that they do so, but you never see anyone sleep. You barely see them eat. It's just like, we're here, and now we're here, and now we're here, and now we're here, and now there's an end. And you're like, wow, okay. Like, I got a nosebleed. We just moved so fast. Like, it's literal hyperspace through narrative. So having that time to sort of expand out is really valuable, and I think could do a lot of good things for a story, but it just requires you to be more aware of, like, your timelines. And I sort of, like, I used to outline all the time before I wrote, but now I will outline after I write the first draft. And I'll just sort of, like, start to build, like, here's the sequence of events as it occurs in the book. And, like, do I need to make sure that that all lines up? Do I need to hit on this and hammer on this a little more? So it's a little tricky. I think there's more work to be done when the story gets longer, just because you want to make it all make sense. And, you know, also not just make sense, but then remind people of the things they need to know as they move through the piece. You know, the story always needs to be that the reader is, like, caught up. Like, you can't be like, well, I want them to, it's so mysterious, they don't know where they are, because in my experience, readers just feel frustrated at being lost. You can only keep them lost for so long before you have to kind of get them right back on the trail.
Presumably, when you're writing over such a long period of time, you've got to keep reorienting the reader on. So if you leave Calla here and then you pick up Calla 3 weeks later, we have to know it's 3 weeks later. We have to know some of what's happening throughout those 3 weeks, where she is now. So it's a lot of words, presumably, spent on just keeping the orientation in place.
Yes. It's like bookkeeping. Like, you're trying to, like, yeah, you're just trying to make sure everybody, or like blocking on a stage or a film set. You're trying to make sure everybody, both internally in a scene, like, where are they and do the movements all make sense? And then sort of externally in the larger sort of time frame, you know, is everybody, are we all keeping track of everybody? And it's really important to do so. It's like weird detail oriented data, but you need to do that for the readers.
Well, to focus on one character as we draw towards an end here, you know, it's impossible really to pick one person as the leader of your group of good guys. But the most intriguing to me, and probably to many, is this figure of John Compass, this apple hunter. He's worn, he's weary, he's a vet who's turned his back on violence. And I wonder, can we talk a little about violence, Chuck?
Yes.
Because it's something that, it's interested me on the back burner for a while, but this book crystallizes it, because Compass is clearly a very capable man physically. He's done bad things, and he's capable of bad things, but he's holding that natural violence in check, even in the face of, like, absurd provocation.
Yes.
Why did you put those guardrails up? Why not let him rip?
For a few reasons. First, like, you know, you have that sort of, like, mythological loner, Ronin ninja cowboy character type, right? The one who's like, I've put my dark life away, but now I must be summoned again to do the dark deed, right? That's the, and, like, you know, John Compass aging, you know, he's almost a Clint Eastwood character in the sort of formation of it. Like, he's very capable of doing violence. He's the Equalizer. He's John Wick, whatever you want to sort of view him as. I mean, obviously not that extreme in that action movie context, but in a real life context, he's obviously very capable. But, like, you know, my view as a storyteller is always like, how can I, what's the turn of the knife? What's the different thing? How do you make that thing be that thing, but, like, a different shape, a different outcome? You know, it's like you talking about, like, how there's an inversion of who you maybe think is going to be hero and villain in the book, and how there's some switch ups on that. So for him, I'm like, well, what if he really just doesn't do the thing that you think he's going to do, which is, like, embrace violence? Like, what if he's a better person than that? And also, like, I grew up in an area where, and I, you know, culturally am connected to the Quaker community somewhat as well. And so it's in its here, it's all around. It's part of the founding of our state here in Pennsylvania. And Quakers, I mean, that's their, that is literally their view, as a pacifistic view. And it's one that, like, I know both they and other people struggle with, is like, how do you maintain like a vigil against a violent world without violence yourself, right? I mean, that's a really a fascinating question to me. And so I was like, well, how do you kind of center that struggle in a single character? And obviously it can't just be like, well, he's a good guy who doesn't do violence, and now he still doesn't do violence. I mean, it's got to be someone who has, he's grappling with something. I mean, the thing we connect to with characters is that struggle, like something that they're constantly wrestling with, because most people, like I say, are messes, and they're all, we're all struggling with something, with some demon, some shadow, some weird version of ourselves. And he is no different than that. And so I just wanted that struggle to play out maybe a little differently than the sort of mythic cut of that character would normally demand.
Get it completely. And I had a similar conversation with John Connolly about his Parker character, who's become much less violent as the books have gone on, the story developed. And I said to him that I worry sometimes about myself, because I still yearn on occasion for a story in which the, you know, the violent righteous man gets to kick the holy shit out of the bad guys.
Oh yeah, and I'm still there. I still like that. Yeah.
Right. Because I've noticed that that character has been taken out of a lot of culture. Like, it used to, me and my wife talked about this last night, when we used to watch, like, she's watching Dawson's Creek, my wife.
Yeah.
And she was watching some show where, I've never seen it, but some episode where one of the characters, his girlfriend is in some way affronted by a school bully. And he walks up and punches him in the face. And it, like, it gives you just this serotonin hit of, you know, that is the world correcting itself. But yes. I do get that that is a terrible sort of lesson to teach, that violence solves problems. But in a story...
Well, yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, you know, Richard Spencer, we're going back to the Nazi thing. That video of him getting punched by an anonymous person did the Lord's work. And it really, it took the stuffing out of not him just physically that day, but it really just like robbed him of something vital. So... it's not that I don't think violence can't be the answer. At times it certainly can be, but especially in the context of this book, right, where it's about the temptation and seduction to do something that is wrong or evil in support of what you believe to be being better, right? I have to be better, but being better requires these sacrifices. So, you know, the question for me was like, what's the line for Compass? Like, how does he, you know, work around that while not being that? Do you know what I mean? Like, how does he not just become one of the apple eaters without being an apple eater? And then also, like, inverting it again, that there are some characters, I think, in this book, without spoiling too much, who do perform violence that maybe you don't expect that they're going to be the people who perform violence. And so, again, inverting, I'm always trying to find ways to invert things, but to do them in a way that's, like we said, organic to the character, and not just like, well, I'm doing it because it's interesting, or I'm doing it because the plot demands it. Like, I want it to be like this. So when you get there and when you see the twist or the shift in their character, you get it. Like, you're like, oh, I am along with you on this ride.
Yeah, completely. And of course, you know, the true evil to be faced in this is a figure in the margins who only appears in a sort of scant few scenes.
Yeah.
Now, gonna tread carefully now. Like, I recognized I recognized the name Nabarius from certain ologies.
Yes, so certain ologies, yeah. Yes.
I knew he was up to no good. And I'm assuming his inclusion stemmed a little bit from that creepy note you found in your sofa.
Oh, absolutely. That's definitely the seed of that. And it also comes from too that there's a sort of a similar character in Book of Accidents.
Right. Well, this is what I want to get at, because for a start, I know you said to me last time that you always like to leave these Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, the one I noticed was that Jed, is it Homaki? Homaki?
Yeah, Jed Homaki.
Homaki. One of his books is referenced, and the Ringing Rocks is referenced in this one. And I wondered whether Nabarius was perhaps a different avatar of a similar evil from that book.
Absolutely, 100%. And then in Book of Accidents, there's a reference to, the Ruby Slipper Apple, to the events of this story.
Wow. Okay,
I planted something back then, all the way back then.
Oh, wow, that's cool. Well, here's my final question about the book. So,
yeah.
And this is my final King reference, I promise. But the very final pages of Black River Orchard remind me very much of how The Stand ends when Flag washes up, ready to start all over again. And I wonder whether Nabarius is your version of the Walking Dude. Do you have more plans for him?
Not specifically, but I will always revisit. I like the idea, not in the grand overarching cosmic horror way, but it's sort of like a keyhole view of that, where there's like the apple. It's not that Nabarius is making you do evil, right? Or forcing evil upon you or being evil to you all the time. But it's like he has pointed the way to what getting what you want if you just were to make these small concessions of your character, sometimes small and sometimes not small. And I like that. I like the idea that the sort of, I am honestly fascinated with a certain class of ology. And so I think there's something interesting there and the personalities of those characters and those figures in sort of mythology and folklore. And so I think having that, it's almost like in the Coen Brothers films, how there's often a figure of evil who is a agitator and a plot mover without necessarily being the character that you are interested in. It's just there's a dark figure of evil who moves things along. Either he's chasing or pursuing or whatever. And I think I continue to be interested in that idea of having a sort of a temptation, a character of temptation. Not necessarily the flag level of like, I'm going to step in here and I am the evil engine, but rather someone who's nudging other people to be a version of that.
So like someone or a thing that is waiting in the margins for the unwary characters of any of your novels.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely, yeah.
That's a neat idea, yeah. Glad we left that vague enough for the unsuspecting reader.
Right.
As we draw to the end, Chuck, would you like to recommend a book for my listeners?
Oh, God, I mean, there's so many. I just finished Hayley Piper's All the Hearts You Eat, and that was, I just blurbed and I referenced an undertow, and I feel like that's appropriate. I just started reading Forgotten Sisters by Cynthia Palaio, and that's amazing. But the book I'd recommend, and I don't think it's hit a lot of people's radar, and I haven't seen a lot of people talking about it. But it feels like a book that was written for me. Like and it's a book that I got for a blurb purposes, and I just didn't get to it, and it passed by me. And then on a lark, I forget even where I was. I was somewhere and it was the only book I had nearby. And I was like, I'll just flip through this right now. And I instantly like tripped and fell into it. It was like, oh, they're my favorite books. They're like when I'm like, I don't have really time to read this book, but now I'm 50 pages in and I can't stop. And it is Fever House by Keith Rawson. It is fucking wild. And it's like, I don't even know what it is. It's like, crime, horror, spy thriller, apocalyptic nightmare book. And it's like being electrocuted. It's really good. And I hope more people read it over time. It's just really good. And it's rock and roll.
It's a mother and son fighting a kind of hand of glory in there, I believe. And
that's like only a fraction of that book. Yes. Yes. But not just that. There's also a spy agency, and there's criminals, and there's, why?
Well, you know he's writing a sequel.
Is he really?
Yeah, because I have a copy of Fever. Is it Fever House?
Fever House.
And I couldn't get Keith on this year because the schedule was too packed, but he's writing a sequel, I believe. That might be proprietary information, sorry. I'm going to get him back on next time when he comes back around. So, yeah, I look forward to reading it. It's funny, you talk about tripping and falling into books. One of the best things I've read this year was something I couldn't fit into the schedule, and normally I can't read things. But I was on a flight, and the only book I had with me was C.J. Leeds' Mayfly. Have you read that?
Oh, I have not. I have it, but I haven't read it. I have heard that it's exactly that, like the book that's like, I have you by the throat now, and I'm just going to take you with me.
Yeah, I was on the way to StokerCon, where I knew she was going to be there. And I was reading it, and I got, and I was like, oh my God, I don't know you, but I've just read your book on the way here. And it is, I was just kind of like, I was just a lot in her face. You know, it is a vicious, funny retelling of American Psycho from a female point of view. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I did a panel with her and P.J. Lee Clark and Delilah Dawson. And of course, obviously, P.J. Lee Clark too, you know, of Ring Shout, since we're just talking books. Anyway, if you haven't read Ring Shout, Jesus Christ.
I haven't read Ring Shout.
Oh, put everything down and read it. It's a novella, so it's very fast. It is one of the greatest, the KKK plus, like, you know, cosmic horror. Really, really, really great. And written in just such a way, you know, that sort of Joe Lansdale, boy, this is going to be easy to get down. Like, it's like, you're just done.
Well, you know what? Because I always say on this show, when people recommend things, yeah, I'll read it, but I've got a flight tomorrow, so a novella will be great. So I will buy it tonight.
And
I will read it. I will read it, and I will tweet you about it. Yeah.
You will thank me. You will thank me. Okay. I promise. Yeah.
Okay. That's tomorrow's flight taken care of. You know what? Last question, Chuck. Last time around, you said quite correctly Twitter, and look how prescient that was. But what truly scares you?
Man, it's like, I'm going to still continue. Obviously, a lot of things scare me, whether we're talking about, I mean, they're all in Wanderers. So Wanderers is like my, you know, coffin of anxieties. But I'll just say, like, the internet scares me. There's a great song by K-Flay called I'm Afraid of the Internet. And it's definitely, it's just that. So it's like, not just Twitter, but it's the sort of like the fragmented lens of all of it, because of all the artificial intelligence and the disinformation, misinformation, and the collapsing of social media. And like, you can't even Google a thing anymore and not have like insane broken links and just garbled AI links. And like, on the first or second scroll down page, like, you're getting stuff that's, I mean, people posted, I think just a few weeks ago, they like asked the Google, you know, search bar, which kind of has its own answer section at the top, is like, how many African countries start with the letter K? And it was like, none. It's like, Kenya's right there, Google. You shouldn't highlight this answer, but they're like, nah, who cares? We just let the weird robot who lives behind the internet answer it, and he's fine now. And he says, no, it's not Kenya. So like, that just freaks me out. Like, that we're just like, kind of all, we've put everything we have in and on the internet, and now it's starting to fail. Like that whole, like when our banks started to get weird here in the country, and it was like the too big to fail problem, like, that's the internet's problem, but nobody's doing anything to shore up this bridge. And we're all standing on the bridge. And I don't know what happens when it really cracks and falls.
I think you're spot on. I mean, and it is showing, like you say, that too big to fail thing. Like, you always think someone else somewhere is taking care of this. And then you realize the people running this shit don't care. All they want is your money.
Yes, you they know? Don't care if it's
and sometimes bad. Sometimes they don't want your money. They just want your adulation, or they just want your attention. And it's
your
just...
eyes. Yeah, your eyes. They want your yeah. Adulation. Well said. Yeah.
That is terrifying. And like I said, like I told you, I'm always recording this in a weird time zone weeks before I actually put it live and stuff. But as of this week, all our flights went down in the UK. We had the entire infrastructure of the air traffic control went down because of one bit, supposedly, of digital malarkey. I don't know. And it's like, talk about too big to fail. Like, what?
Yeah.
Everything we've got is put in someone else's hard drive, and we're so contingent on it. And I find that terrifying.
Oh, and you're flying tomorrow.
Yeah. But I'll have Ring Shout to read, so, you know, it could be worse.
Yeah.
Chuck, you said a minute ago that it was a book that was written just for you. I feel like Black River Orchard was written just for me, and I genuinely mean that. It's not false praise. It's a big, thick, immersive, slow-burning, mythological, lovely, comfy, warm bath of a novel. And if any of those things sound like a good read to people, I recommend buying it. It's out today at the time this episode goes live. And, well, Chuck Wendig, thanks for writing it, and thanks for talking scared.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I stand by the trifecta of comparisons I made right at the start of that conversation. The Tommyknockers stroke Needful Things link feels clear to me. I think Chuck, more than any other living writer, including Joe Hill, captures the expansive, humane weirdness of King's 80s and 90s fiction. Book of Accidents felt that way, but this one really does. And it feels like the Tommyknockers and Needful Things in particular, because it's so weird, and because, like we discussed, it delivers its horrors within the authentic parameters of a working town. It's a quiet apocalypse that's happening incrementally behind the scenes, and then slowly dominates, all whilst the shops stay open. The comparison to Jack Finney's The Body Snatchers is clear too. I mean, there's this sense of creeping paranoia and friends who may no longer be friends. And if Chuck had written this book way back when, it would definitely have been like a McCarthy-era allegory. And then there's John Langan's The Fisherman. And you could hear how pleased Chuck was with that reference, I think. I don't think there's any writer who is better at creating modern American mythologies than John Langan. Honestly, The Fisherman is one of the best American novels of the century, and if you haven't read it, I beseech you to. There's a new UK edition coming out next month, I believe, quite soon. The Fisherman feels like a piece of lore that John has unearthed rather than imagined, and Black River Orchard echoes that, because there are layers of history to this town and to this evil apple, things that we didn't go into in this conversation because there's just too much to talk about. But like The Fisherman, Chuck's book feels genuine and simultaneously human and otherworldly. So those comps hopefully show how much I enjoyed this book. And normally I describe it as a kind of, you know, great summer holiday read, full of characters and on an epic scale. But it comes out so perfectly timed for autumn, or fall, if that's the word you choose. Curl up in a chair with a blanket and a pumpkin spice latte or the marketing engineered beverage of your choice and enjoy. And I should also apologise again that I didn't manage to have Chuck on the show to talk about Wanderers and Wayward, because I know that duology is a favourite of so many of you. And I was so excited to read it myself. But I was just so burned out by reading at that pace for the entire year that I just couldn't face the pressure of reading a pair of 1,000-page novels in time for the episode. And I knew I was cracking up at the time, because Wanderers is full of all this kind of disease info about various strange maladies that befall the human body. And it really started playing on my hypochondriacal mind. So I thought, yeah, perhaps take a week off, Neil. I still haven't caught up with either of those books, but many of you tell me I should, so maybe over Christmas. What do you think? Before I go, I will just give out one more shout out to CJ Lead and Mayfly. Now, I gave my review of the book in earnest over on the latest Hushed Tones episode. That's exclusive to Patreon, so if you want to hear it, go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod and sign up. But it's a fucking brilliant book. Brilliant. But if any of you know CJ, please offer my apologies, because I started reading Mayfly on the plane to StokerCon, and then I got so excited by how good it was that when I saw her at the event, I kind of strolled across the room and accosted her. That's bad enough, but I actually met her with my thoughts on this scene in which a character describes the sensuality of getting into a bath full of eggshells. And I think I said something like, it made me feel funny in a good way. So imagine that. You go to an event and a British guy who you've never met marches up to you and tells you that you've alerted him to an eggshell fetish that he himself wasn't aware of. Yeah, if you see CJ, tell her I'm sorry. If anyone wants to get in touch with me or the show, it's the usual places, talkingscaredpod@gmail.com for email and @talkscaredpod on Insta, Twitter, Blue Sky and TikTok. I love to hear from you people. I'm back next week with a big one. We return to the most infamous bad place in all of American letters, Hill House, and we go in the company of Liz Hand and her new novel, A Haunting on the Hill. Until then, though, take a walk, eat a balanced diet, and don't negotiate with Nazis. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.